Guys, a podcast about amateur radio and so much more. Tonight's presentation, Expedition of the Kon-Tiki by K6SUN, is brought to you by Southcard, home of the TNT Open Forum. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy our show.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and all those ships out at sea. KY6V here. This is Southcars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This TNT Open Forum is conducted under the guidelines of the Southcars organization. I'm very, very happy to introduce Kathy, our one and only K6SUN, better known as Miss Sunshine, will be putting on a program on Kon-Tiki this evening and the voyage of the Kon-Tiki that took place back in 1947. It stirred the hearts and the minds of many, many people, stirred the interest in a lot who built their own rafts and tried to sail from here to there at different points after the Kon-Tiki had made its long trip. She is going to be accompanied this evening with a support staff in the program. That'll be Jim, KJ4WKD, Mike, WA4NXI, Suzanne, N1SUZ, Rob, VE3CQK, and George, KW4LCB. So kick your shoes off, grab your favorite beverage, and let's have some fun. Kathy, KY6V to you. Over.
Good evening, everyone. It's I hope you have time to relax this evening and enjoy the program. I found a lot of interesting information about the Kon-Tiki. As a history teacher, it's information I was not well aware of. And so a lot of this information is new to me, but I hope that you enjoy what we have in store for you this evening. So, like Gordon said, our topic is Kon-Tiki Exposition and the involvement of ham radio in that exposition. The procedure this evening, and Gordon told you pretty much the staff that will be helping me, is a question and answer session. But we do want participation of all listeners out there with comments and any questions you may have. So after I've made my information, maybe I'll ask for questions or comments and you can come aboard. Let's begin this evening, and I'm going to call first on Jim, KJ4WKD, and ask him to come aboard with his first question.
Thank you, Kathy, and thank you, Gordon, as well, and thanks to all the panelists who are going to ask questions, and everyone who is connected who will ask questions as well and make comments about this. This is a fascinating subject. That year, 1947, I'm not going to tell you what that means to me, but it's an important year for me. It's on my driver's license. But, Kathy, can you give us an introduction, give us a little more, to just get us started tonight, about the Kon-Tiki? And you already have my interest, but spark some other interest tonight. I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and as some others did, those of us who grew up during that period of time might laugh at anyone who asked that question, what is the Kon-Tiki expedition? But there might be some others here who don't remember or don't remember to talk about it. So, Kathy, would you come back and just introduce the subject again and tell us, expand it a little bit for us? Would you do that? This is KJ4WKD. Turn it back to you, Kathy.
All right. Thank you, Jim. But no, I never said a test. I said maybe at the end, if time allowed, we just see what people learn from this evening, maybe some new information. I wouldn't want to give you a test. But I will give you some introduction on the Kon-Tiki. Many people who grew up in the 50s and 60s, like Jim said, which is myself and maybe a lot of us connected, would have laughed at anyone if asked, what is the Kon-Tiki Exposition? Unfortunately, since today, you cannot learn about it by watching TV unless it is a history channel. It seems an increasing number of people think of Kon-Tiki may be something to do with a Mai Tai or a restaurant. And I will tell you, here in Fort Pierce, we do have a restaurant that's called Kon-Tiki. But in 1947, everyone was telling the Norwegian explorer, his name is Thor Heyerdahl, and maybe I mispronounced his name, it couldn't be done. They were talking about his theory. He felt that Indians from Peru had sailed to the South Pacific sometime in their distant past. They couldn't get there, they said, because they had no boats. All they had were rafts made of balsa wood. 54 years ago, after the exposition, the Kon-Tiki still lives in our minds, and most archaeologists still maintain strong opinions on the subject. The actual raft itself still survives in the Kon-Tiki Museum in Oslo, Norway. The museum is one of the positive and lasting legacies of the exposition, and today serves as a research center for Pacific prehistory. The Kon-Tiki has also survived in popular culture. The name has been applied to all manner of products and services with the apparent intent to connote a sense of adventure or an atmosphere of the South Pacific. In 1997, a research of the name Kon-Tiki on the internet revealed an amazing variety, including the following: scuba diving schools in Thailand and the Philippines, solar power products in Slovenia, a brand of camper caravans and a style of yacht, a travel bureau in Yugoslavia, scouting groups in the Netherlands and South Africa, drinking establishments in the Virgin Islands in Arizona, a resort in Fiji, and a hotel in Turkey. These join a long list of poems, songs, and even varieties named after the Kon-Tiki. So I hope that gives everyone just an introduction of the name Kon-Tiki and what this exposition involves. Okay, I hope everyone enjoyed that introduction. With that, I'm going to call on WA1NXI, who's up there in the state of Maine, to give me the second question. And thanks so much for being there this evening, Mike.
This is WA1NXI. Good evening, Kathy, and good evening to everybody aboard. Had a wonderful day here in the state of Maine. And as you know, Kathy, when you asked me to be a part of this, I asked you, or I told you I didn't even know where Kon-Tiki was. But now, unlike Jim, I'm all ready for that test at the end. I looked into it in a very, very interesting and amusing topic. So my question to you would be, if you could give us any information about the crew of the Kon-Tiki.
All right, Mike, I so appreciate you being there and helping out this evening, and I hope you enjoyed the YouTube video as well as the other information. But there's a lot of information out there, a lot of information I won't go through tonight. It would be too involved. But I would like to talk a little bit about the crew. The Kon-Tiki crew consisted of 6 men. Financing was always touch and go, but it was a snap. I will pronounce his name, Heyerdahl, his first name is Thor, finding members who would be willing to go along on what the National Geographic Society technical consultant said was a suicide mission. All of the members were Norwegian, except for his last name was Danielsen. He was a Swede. But Thor was the exposition leader. He had studied the ancient people of South Africa and Polynesia and believed that there was a link between the two. The next member, his last name was Heselberg, was the navigator. He was an artist. He painted the large Kon-Tiki figure on the raft sail. The next one, his last name was Danielsen. He took on the role of the steward, in charge of supplies and daily rations. He was a Swedish sociologist interested in human migration theory. And he also served as a translator, as he was the only member of the crew who spoke Spanish. He was also an avid reader, Suzanne. His box aboard the raft contained many books. The next, who was one of the radio experts, his last name was Hoglan, and I hope I pronounced that right. He was decorated by the British in World War II for his actions in the Norwegian heavy water sabotage that stalled what were believed to be German plans to develop an atomic bomb. His last name was Rabbi. He was also in charge of the radio transmissions. He gained radio experience while hiding behind the German lines. His secret radio transmissions eventually helped guide in the Allied bombers to sink the ship. It was the battleship, the Trapeze. The last one I want to talk about, his last name is Watzinger, was an engineer whose area of expertise was in technical measurements. He was the first to join Thor for the trip. He collected and recorded all sorts of data on the voyage. Much of what he recorded, such as weather data, was sent back to various people since this area of the ocean was largely understudied. Before they left New York, Thor had obtained valuable diplomatic contacts at the United Nations. Now, following a personal interview with the Peruvian president, he obtained permission to build the raft in the naval dockyard in Peru. The raft was christened the Contiki, after the pre-Inca figure that Thor believed left South Africa by this raft, only to show up as the Polynesian deity named Tiki. At this point, I'm going to call on our lady this evening, Suzanne, to give me the next question. And Suzanne, thanks so much for joining our staff this evening.
Well, good evening, Kathy, and everybody tonight. This is N1SUZ, and yes, Kathy, a great subject, a great topic. I also did not know anything about Contiki until you brought it up, and I found it very interesting, and so I'm looking forward to the whole net tonight to learn even more. So I'd like to know, in every event that occurs in our daily lives, questions always need to be answered. So could you tell us, Kathy, who was involved in the Contiki expedition? And what was the Contiki expedition and what occurred? When it occurred and where did it take place? And how did it occur? Could you give us a brief description and then maybe later a little bit more detailed description?
All right. Thank you, Suzanne. But I told you a little bit about the crew. There were six members, but I'll briefly go into some of the other information, and hopefully as we move on, there'll be more detailed information for you. But like I said, there were six members. Contiki was the name given to the raft by the Norwegian explorer, Herodal, and he was also a writer, Suzanne, like I said. This was a 1947 exposition to show that there was no technical reasons why to prevent the people from South America settling Polynesia in the South Pacific in pre-Columbian times. He and a small team, and I told you that was five other members, went to Peru, where they used trees and other native materials to construct a balsa wood raft. And if you know what balsa wood is, it's pretty thin. On August 7, 1947, a strange vessel crashed on the coral reefs and I'm going to say this, I'm maybe wrong, it's the Tuamotu Islands. Tuamotu, I will say that, islands. After sailing for 101 days and over 4,300 miles across the Pacific Ocean, its tanned and weather-beaten crew of six Scandinavians survived the experience and cheerfully planted a souvenir from the source of their journey, a coconut palm carried on board their vessel from South America. This extraordinary voyage across the Pacific on a raft of balsa wood named Contiki would have an enduring effect on both the world and the popular culture. Briefly, I want to say that the only modern equipment they had was a radio. And for food, they lived off the fruits of the ocean, and that will be discussed a little bit more later. So anyone out there, and that goes for the staff as well, that would like to make any comments, please come aboard with a suffix.
Lima Oscar, uniform.
All right. Good evening, Ted. I hope that you're enjoying it this evening. What is your comment? Please come aboard.
I'd like to add to the process another reason that the expedition occurred. What I found out when I took interest in this was that the leader, Thor Heyerdahl, had made an earlier trip to the Polynesian Islands, and he found some statues that were carved out of rock and so forth over there that were very similar to the statues that he knew existed in the Peru area. And through this information, he was convinced, that is, he convinced himself, that the only way that this kind of artist or artistic statues or whatever you want to call them occurred was that the people from Peru ended up over in Polynesia, and when they got there, they made these statues. And I think that's what was kind of driving him to put this expedition together, Kathy. Back to you. This is WB Tolio.
All right, Ted. I'd like to maybe give you a comment that I also learned before I asked for any other stations to come aboard. He and his wife, I believe, went over there to Polynesia to do just what you said, research and find out the information. I understand they acquired diseases and came back with quite some information, and I didn't include that tonight but it was very interesting. I know that him and his I think it was his new wife went over there and spent some time over there and like I said researched everything. And yes, you are right. I think it's why he wanted to do this exposition, because he was very definite that it could be done. So, Lou, do you have any other comments? But did you read about them, both the wife and him, making that exposition? I think that's the one you're talking about. I'll turn it back to you, Ted.
Yeah, if you do a search for the information overall, you'll find that's very correct. In fact, I just found out today, I didn't realize, I did some tweaking around. And I don't know the guy's name, but the king at that time of Polynesia had actually adopted Thor Heyerdahl as his son, which I found that quite interesting. That was very interesting.
Yes, I read a lot of that, and I think his name was Tiki, if I remember. I don't know if it was Khan Tiki. I think it was Tiki. But I'm not sure if I'll go into that a little bit later, but I did have that originally, and a lot of the information I found, and Ted, I think it was a great topic. I learned a great deal by listening to the video and finding a lot of information, and I may not go into everything tonight, but I do remember reading that. So I'll break with you. Is there any other comments from anyone out there that would like to come aboard, make a question or a comment of either what Ted has said or myself to this point? If so, come aboard with a suffix.
WKD. Well, Kathy, it might be a little premature, but I've heard you say radio a couple of times. I want to ask you if you don't have to tell me what's involved, but I'm betting you're going to bring it up later. So to Pac-Man real quickly. And I hope everyone will stay aboard to hear about that. So I'm sure radio is going to come up. Can you speak to that just briefly?
Well, Jim, I want to have everyone stay connected to listen to it. Ham radio had a great deal to do with this exposition. There were the radio operators on board. They had the equipment. But it was a lot to do with... remember I said they had a crash, so maybe they were calling out there for help. And I will go into that in quite detail further down about their voyage, Jim, talking about the voyage and the conversation that they may have had with radio operators. But I will go into that. I will also go into the station they used. But that's further down, and I do want to keep everyone's interest, because we are all ham radio operators, and I think this is very interesting to learn. So I will hold off until a little further down the line, Jim, if that's okay. So are there any other questions from anyone else out there before I move on?
Lima, Charlie, Bravo.
Well, good evening, George, and thanks so much for helping out this evening as well. Hope it's not another question, but I hope it's a comment. So please come aboard.
Yes'm. It sure is. You know, being one of those Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn sorts, I played with Rass, and you mentioned balsa wood. Why they picked a balsa wood, it is very buoyant. It's awful light, you know, and I haven't had occasion of dealing with balsa wood at times, and I was surprised just how light it was and to use there, and had different experiences with it too. So that's why I thought to throw that in there. That's why they decided on a balsa wood there. Very interesting how they was able to obtain it there, as I read the article there. But you might have time to go into that later on. KW4 Lima, Charlie Bravo. Thank you.
Well, thank you, George. Yes, I know balsa wood, what they have now. I've worked with it with my son when he was young, and so it's very light. So that's interesting what you came aboard with. Yes, we hope to go on further. I hope to talk about the raft itself and the voyage itself, and so that will be a little further. And I hope that everyone is finding this quite interesting, because us as a staff that's involved tonight, I think, did find it quite interesting. So with that, I'm going to call on the next person to ask me the question, and that is you, Gordon. Can you come aboard with the next question?
I'd be pleased to, Kathy. Thank you. Hello, George. Hello, Ted. A couple of quick comments in their direction. It seemed to me in my reading, George, that the balsa wood was treated with some kind of a local substance to give it some sturdiness after being in the water for, what was their trip? I think 101 days. So they added some kind of a preservative so that the wood wouldn't start to dissipate. And Ted, I think that in my readings, I got the impression that the hierarchy in South America got into a political arena of some sort, and some of them had to flee. And one of the leading sun gods, who I think's name was Tiki, now I could be mistaken on that, is believed to have traversed the same trip that they're taking in the raft, got over to the Polynesian Islands and started to cultivate the cultural environment out there. And if I'm not mistaken, I'd have to go back and reread this again, Ted, but I think when they took their trip and were finally picked up and taken to Tahiti, I believe that the person that was in charge at that time took on Thor as his son, but I could be mistaken. Any rate, Kathy, my question sort of leads into the reasoning behind the expedition number one, and I found a lot of people have got so excited and emotional about this Kon-Tiki trip. I don't think you've mentioned that it's 101 days and 4,000 plus miles across the Pacific Ocean, but I'm sure you'll be getting to that. These other people that have tried these raft rides all had their reasoning behind it. And the guy that I think of and a situation that I was familiar with out in California was a rafting episode called the Lehigh. It was being sponsored by a guy by the name of Baker, and he was Mormon. And he was trying to prove that this type of travel took place many, many, many years ago and was a foundation for some of the information that is in the Mormon Bible. So at any rate, my question, what was the theory behind the reason for the expedition? You've touched on it, but go into it a little further, if you will. Tell us how this theory was determined. KY6V, back to you, ma'am.
All right. Thank you, Gordon. And in this answer to that question, Ted, I will be talking a little bit about the chief. But yes, I did say a little bit earlier, I think when Suzanne asked me about the exposition, I said the days and the length. But further on, if we get that far, Gordon, I was going to ask about other expositions, because the Heyerdahl had a lot, and there's been a lot since then. So maybe you can come aboard at that time and talk a little bit more about the Lehigh. But let me go into a little bit the reason. And I talked just briefly about it, but let me go into more detail. Although a connection with South America was his original focus, Heyerdahl never rejected the Southeast Asiatic origins of the historically known Polynesians. After his first year in Polynesia, and this is what Ted was talking about and I was talking about when he and his wife, he traveled to British Columbia to search for possible traces of the route he favored, from the Philippine Sea to Polynesia by way of the Pacific Northwest coast. Having been issued a challenge, he initiated what would be known as the Kon-Tiki Expedition. This classic case of experimental archaeology would replicate and test a South American balsa raft sailing vessel. The experiment would test ideas both about the seaworthiness of the vessels and the directional forces of currents and the winds to propel such a vehicle to Polynesia. It was the theory of him that the settlement of the Pacific Islands resulted from a migration of American peoples who had sailed there many years ago, rather than a trek from Asia, as claimed by other scientists. To prove that such a migration was possible, he decided to attempt the trip in a raft of the type preserved in Inca legends and early Spanish historical accounts. He named the expedition in honor of the pre-Inca sun god. His aim was to show, by using only the materials and technologies available to those people at the time, that there was no technical reason to prevent them from having done so. Although the expedition carried some modern equipment, such as the radio, watches, charts, maps, diagrams, and knives, he argued that they were incidental to the purpose of proving that the raft itself could make the journey. He has always been dedicated to attempting to prove his theories on contacts of prehistoric societies with the aid of traditional boat types. He wanted to develop his theory further about the Pacific Islands. So, Ted, this is when he, along with his wife, went on an expedition where they discovered that the trade winds blew from east to west, suggesting that the settlers on the islands may have come from South America. He received a piece of information that strengthened this theory. He heard a story regarding the massacre of bearded white men who were responsible for building the pyramids in Peru. The chief god of the white men escaped. His name was Kon-Tiki. He further believed that the white men's chief god, which was called Sun-Tiki, who had been driven out of Peru, was the same as the white god Kon-Tiki, the sun of the sun. The sun, the second sun is spelled S-U-N, who founded the Polynesian race. The exposition clearly demonstrated the possibility that such contacts could have taken place by disproving prevailing notion that early South American watercraft were incapable of surviving an ocean voyage. So I hope that gives you some extra information on what Ted was saying and what Gordon was saying. I am going to again call on KY6V to give me the next question. And thanks so much, Gordon, for being there and doing dual duty this evening.
No problem. My pleasure, Kathy. This is a simple question, Kathy. I have a picture of the Kon-Tiki raft, but for those who haven't, can you give us a description of the raft, what it looked like, and would you sail 4,000 miles in that baby? Over.
Well, no, I probably wouldn't. It took me quite a bit of encouragement to get on a boat to go on the ocean the first time I did scuba diving, so I don't think I could do this. But anyone, after I go over the description, if you just do a search on the internet on the Kon-Tiki Expedition, you should see a lot of information. You should see what that raft looked like, maybe the crew as well. So, and I hope you do check that out after we've had this session this evening. But first of all, the Kon-Tiki, it was a balsa wood raft built with balsa logs from Ecuador, topped by a bamboo platform that was built by Heyerdahl and his five-member crew. The main body of the raft was composed of 9 balsa tree trunks up to 13.7 meters, that's 45 feet long, 60 centimeters, 2 feet in diameter, lashed together with 3.175 centimeters, that's 1 1/4 inch hemp ropes. Cross pieces of the balsa log were 18 feet long and 1 foot in diameter were lashed across the logs at 3 foot intervals to give lateral support. So that's a lot of technical information, but some of you who are been in the Navy or are sailors or are boaters probably, that is very good information. Pine splashboards clad the bow, and lengths of pine 1 inch thick and 2 feet wide were wedged between the balsa logs and used as center boards. The main mast was made of lengths of mangrove wood lashed together to form an A-frame 29 feet high. Behind the main mast was a cabin of plaited bamboo 14 feet long and 8 feet wide, was built about 4 to 5 feet high and roofed with banana leaf thatch. At the stern was a 19 foot long steering oar of mangrove wood with a blade of fir. The mainsail was 15 by 18 feet on a yard of bamboo stems lashed together. Photographs also show that a topsail above the mainsail and also a mizzen sail mounted at the stern. And those of you who are sailors and fishermen and boaters probably know this information way more than I, and so I hope you come up with comments. The raft was partially decked in split bamboo. The main spars were a laminate of wood and reeds, and he tested more than 20 different composites before settling on one that proved an effective compromise between bulk and torsional rigidity, and no metal was used in the construction. So, any of you sailors, boaters, anyone that's been on the water, maybe constructing things, want to come aboard and make some comments here, probably everyone listening would appreciate that. So maybe you can give a better and clearer explanation. What did this raft exactly look like? So are there anyone out there that would like to come aboard and make some comments? Staff or listeners, please come aboard.
Lima Oscar Uniform.
Well, good evening once again, Ted. How about coming aboard and giving us some comments?
Well, the description is quite vivid. I'm rather fortunate, I think, in this respect, for the reason that I've actually stood by the Contiki raft, I have touched the Contiki raft, and I have video and some photographs that my wife took when we visited the museum in Oslo many, many years ago. It was quite an experience, and exactly as you've described it is how I remember it was to me. It is a marvel. It is absolutely a marvel. And if anybody ever has the opportunity to visit that museum in Oslo, make sure you stop by and take a look at that raft. And you're going to wonder, how did they do it?
Well, Ted, I've seen pictures of that raft, and I'm not sure how I could have ever done it, especially with high seas. I've been on some boats when I was scuba diving with 12-foot seas, and it was hard, so I can't imagine it. But, you know, I would sure appreciate a picture if you have one of those pictures you took in Oslo and see what it actually looks like other than seeing it on the website. So, and I hope everyone else can get a picture in their mind of this raft going on the ocean and just think of it being balsa wood in a sail up and thinking of the measurements I gave you and wondering if you could have done this, and I know I couldn't have. Okay, I thank everyone for listening this evening, but hope that you're enjoying it. Hope that you're understanding a little bit about the Contiki. At this point, I'm going to call on George, KW4LCB, to come up with his next question. And once again, George, thanks for being there. And any other comments you'd like to make this evening, I sure hope you come aboard.
Well, thank you again there, Kathy. I might comment as far as I've made one or two rafts in my day and got them out off the beach there. You know, and it's basically, you know, you you climb up the wave and you come down the back side of it. Sometimes you get one that hits you to the side and it makes you hang on. So it can be fun. But the next question, very interesting about, you know, how the raft was made there. Next time I decide to make one, and who knows, I just might. But I'm really interested about a detailed description of the voyage there. You know, that very interesting trip there, and I'm quite sure them guys went through a lot. I like to hear just some of the things that they might have went through. Back to you.
All right, thank you, George, and I'm sure you can make another boat to go out on the ocean. But the exposition began on April 28th, 1947. And Jim, you should be listening to this because you're going to be tested on this at the end. With the raft being towed by a tug to get them outside the shipping lanes and to give them a bit of a leg up and getting away from the coastal currents and wind patterns. Once again, that exposition started on April 28th, 1947, before I was born. But Jim was born then. The Kon-Tiki successfully crossed the Pacific Ocean in a 45-foot raft made of balsa wood and bamboo to prove that people from South America could have settled Polynesia in pre-Columbian times. Heyerdahl and his companion sailed the raft for 101 days, more than 4,300 miles across the Pacific Ocean before smashing into a reef in the Tuamotu Islands on August 7, 1947. The two radio operators, and here's where radio comes in, had been in the Norwegian underground and had used a small radio set in sabotage work against the Germans in World War II. They used this radio in a national NC-173 amateur radio receiver. Both were powered by batteries and a hand cranked generator that the crew continuously cranked when on the air. Their call signs were LI2B. Try to remember that. LI2B were familiar to many who daily kept in touch by amateur radio. Tuna, bonito, shark, and dolphins were in abundance and provided their steady diet. Sailing 50 to 60 miles a day in the Humboldt Current and prevailing easterly wind, the raft could only go forward towards Polynesia. A heavy storm sent 15-foot waves over their raft, severely damaging the cabin and the large steering oar. A cry of, "Man overboard!" had all hands struggling to rescue one of the radio operators who narrowly escaped death. After 97 days, they sighted Angatu Island, but due to high wind, could not land. With limited steering and heavy wind, they were unable to avoid the Rainoa Island Reef 4 days later and prepared to crash. One of the radio operators was on the amateur radio set, and his last words were, "Okay, 50 yards left, here we go, goodbye." They all survived, but one suffered a concussion after falling debris. They saw no one and felt somewhat like Robinson Crusoe. Radio amateurs around the world were anxiously trying to contact them, but the salvage wet radio could not work until it dried out. Half an hour after being stranded, LI2B was fortunate in making contact with ZK1AB on Rarotonga, who was asked to stand a listening watch and communicate with the Norwegian embassy in Washington. If LI2B was not heard at the end of the 36-hour period. Just before the specified period ended, contact was established with WZ0MNU, and word of the landing passed along, thus avoiding the necessity of sending out any rescue parties for station. So let me just go through that, and we'll move on. But this was a conversation among the crew, and I wanted to share this with everyone. Coils and radio parts lay drying in the tropical sun on slabs of coral. The whole day passed, and the atmosphere grew more and more hectic. Everyone abandoned all of their jobs and crowded around the radio in hopes of being able to give assistance. They had to be on the air before 10 p.m. because the 36-hour time limit would be up. And the radio amateur on Rarotonga would send out appeals for airplane and relief expositions. Noon came, afternoon came, and the sun set. If only the man on Rarotonga could contain himself. 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. The tension was at breaking point. Not a sign of life in the transmitter. But the receiver, an NC-173, began to liven up somewhat at the bottom of the scale, and we heard faint music, but not on the amateur wavelength. It was eating its way up. However, perhaps it was a wet coral which was drying inward from one end. The transmitter was still stone dead, short circuits and sparks everywhere. I hope that you're just feeling that what they're going through at this point. The 36 hours, there was less than an hour left. This would never do. The regular transmitter was given up, and a little sabotage transmitter from wartime was tried again. It had been tested several times before in the course of the day, but without result. Now perhaps it had become a little drier. All the batteries were completely ruined, and we got power from cranking a tiny hand generator. It was heavy, and we four who were laymen in radio matters took turns all day long sitting and turning the infernal thing. The 36 hours would soon be up. I remember someone whispering, 7 minutes more, 5 minutes more, and then no one would look at his watch again. The transmitter was as dumb as ever, but the receiver was sputtering upward towards the right wavelength. Suddenly it crackled on the Rarotonga man's frequency, and we gathered that he was in full contact with the telegraph station in Tahiti. Soon afterward, we picked up the following fragment of a message sent out. No plane this side of Samoa, I am quite sure. Then it died away again. The tension was unbearable. What was brewing out there? Had they already begun to send out plane and rescue expositions? Now, no doubt, messages concerning us were going over the air in every direction. The two operators worked feverishly. The sweat trickled from their faces as freely as it did from ours, who sat turning the handle. Power began slowly to come into the transmitter area, and one of the operators pointed to an arrow which swung slowly up over a scale when he held the Morse key down. Now it was coming. We turned the handle madly while Rarotonga was called. No one heard us. Once more, now the receiver was working again, but they still didn't hear us. We called stations in Los Angeles and the Naval School at Lima, but no one heard us. Then one of the operators sent out a CQ message. That is to say, he called all the stations in the world which could hear us on our special amateur wavelength. That was of some use. Now a faint voice out in the ether began to call us slowly. We called again and said that we heard him. Then the slow voice out in the ether said, "My name is Paul. I live in Colorado. What is your name and where do you live?" This was a radio amateur. One of the operators seized the key while we turned the handle and replied, "This is the Contique. We are stranded on a desert island in the Pacific." Paul did not believe the message. He thought it was an amateur radio in the next street pulling his leg, and he did not come on the air again. We tore our hair out in desperation. Here we are sitting under the palm trees on a starry night on a desert island, and no one even believed what we said. The radio operators did not give up. He was at the key again, sending "all well, all well, all well" unceasingly. We must at all costs stop all the rescue machinery from starting out across the Atlantic. Then we heard, rather faintly in the receiver, "If all's well, why worry?" And all was quiet in the ether. That was all. We could have leaped into the air and shaken down all the coconuts for sheer desperation, and heaven knows what we should have done if both Rarotonga and other stations had not suddenly heard us. The stations wept for delight. They said at hearing LI2B again. All the tension stopped immediately. We were once more alone and undisturbed on our South Sea Island and turned in, worn out, on our beds of palm trees. Soon they were discovered by friendly natives and taken to Chief. His name was Tika, T-I-K-A. Upon hearing their story, he ordered a celebration of feasting, dancing, and singing that lasted for days. Two schooners arrived to take the crew and tow the damaged Kentucky to Tahiti. As they were leaving the island, all the natives were shedding tears. In Tahiti, there were more celebrations. Then a Norwegian ship lifted the Kentucky aboard and sailed with crew to America. Later, the Kentucky was taken to Norway, where it is now on display in the Oslo Museum, as Ted has seen. Thor and the others returned to America, which was San Francisco, on a Norwegian ship sent specially to pick them up. So Kentucky demonstrated that it was possible for a primitive raft to sail the Pacific Ocean with relative ease and safety, especially to the west with the wind, and there is no technical reason to prevent people from South America from having settled in Polynesian Island. This exposition demonstrated there was no technical, and I already said that, so I won't go any further. But at this point, I'm going to call on our net manager, Jim, to read me the next question, and we're going to start getting involved in how amateur radio became involved. And everyone, you will find that some of this is repetitious, but I hope that you do stay connected and listen to it all. So, Jim, please come aboard with the next question.
There we go. Thanks, Kathy. I appreciate you letting me ask another question. And by the way, I was not born yet in April of 1947. And I was not a history major, by the way, but I am an amateur radio operator. So I'm really glad we're getting into the amateur radio aspect of the Kentucky voyage and exposition. The Kentucky voyage. But we've talked already about amateur radio and its involvement, and I want to hear more. That's just where I am. I want to hear more about amateur radio and what happened on the voyage and afterwards. So if you could pick it up there and just keep it going with amateur radio, I'd like to hear it, Kathy. KJ4WKD here, back to you, K6SUN.
All right, thank you so much, Jim, and hopefully my voice won't wear out, but I haven't been talking to students this week, just been attending training, so I should be okay. But I want to talk a little bit about amateur radio, because it was quite involved. You heard about the conversation. So they were quite involved. And Ted, we will go in a little further with the amateur radio as well as the station in a couple of the questions. And I sure hope that some of you come aboard if you have any further comments. But let me go into how amateur radio was involved. And nice to know you weren't born in April, Jim. But some of us in our youth were thrilled to read about the voyage of the Kentucky in 1947. But Heyerdahl and his band of adventurers built this balsa raft, like I've talked about, in Peru and set sail for Polynesia to prove that the South Pacific Islands could have been populated from South America. I talked in quite length about the involvement of ham radio operators above, but let me say just some comments further. In 1947, amateur radio played a critical role in the success and safety of this 100-day Kentucky raft exposition, which used the call sign, once again, LI2B, on the amateur bands. One of the two radio operators operated the LI2B aboard the Kentucky using tube gear powered mostly to dry batteries. Again, the station, LI2B, kept a schedule with W1AWs and other stations during the historic voyage. The Kentucky voyage through Pacific Ocean used amateur radio equipment to communicate from the small raft on the high sea. Throughout the voyage, Thor, along with his 5-member crew, collected meteorological and oceanography data and sent that back to the USA via ham radio stations scattered around the globe. In fact, the crew kept in touch with the outside world through ham radio stations only. It was the sole sign of their being present in the modern world. Even nowadays, when a professional communication system is getting 100% reliable, navigators are found to use ham radio equipment because ham radio, guys, hear that, ham radio has got its own advantages too. The group wanted to be able to communicate with the outside world and thus recruited a couple of seasoned radio operators. I hope you guys are just excited as I was when I read this with this presentation tonight. The Radio Amateur League of America, which is probably called AWRL, arranged to have amateurs listening for reports from the raft. The Kon-Tiki radios were built both from scratch and also from secret sabotage sets from World War II. An NC-173 receiver was also used. It appears only Morse code was used as there is no reference to phone operations and only keys and peculiar clickings were mentioned by Heyerdahl, who apparently did not understand the code. The only reference to power and frequency were to a maximum of 6 watts and the frequency as being 13,990 kc. So this was definitely a QRP operation. Constant attention and tinkering was needed to keep their equipment operational. For instance, the batteries were kept charged with a hand-cranked generator. The small craft's aerials also needed special care as they were raised by kite and balloon. No one anticipated the group's pet parrot, now this is interesting, would bite through and eat portions of the wire antenna. And water, water everywhere meant keeping their gear dry. And it was no little task. The Kon-Tiki's initial transmission, when it completed its journey, was delayed while they dried out their equipment. So maybe anyone can come aboard and say any equipment that's gotten wet. That first contact happened to be with an amateur in Colorado, and I talked about that, who thought they were just pulling a fast one on them. So after that, they were stranding on a desert island in the Pacific. Nightly, you know, like I said, they sent out reports and weather observations, which were picked up by random hams who relayed the messages to various destinations. Eventually, sheds were developed by which fairly regular reports could be made, both officially and to friends and family. But one evening, a contact was made with a Norwegian station, which at that point was completely on the other side of the globe from the Kon-Tiki. Congratulations on King, and his name was Kakon's 75th birthday. Were delayed, and the next day the King responded by wishing the crew good luck and success. I found that interesting. For the first 22 days following their departure from Peru, the only radio contact Kon-Tiki had was with OBE, the station of the Peruvian Naval School. LI-2B kept to its schedule, trying to contact key amateur stations on specified frequencies without success. But on May 20th at 9:45 Pacific Standard Time, W6EVM heard and worked that station on 14.142 kilohertz, providing the raft with its first North American contact. By mid-June, the station had worked numerous amateur stations. As the trip progressed, a long-haul network of amateur stations developed. Stations in North America, the Canal Zone in Norway, cooperated in handling the Kon-Tiki's traffic. W3FNG in Washington, D.C., relayed messages to and from the Norwegian embassy. On at least 2 occasions, urgent traffic was exchanged between the embassy and the raft via this circuit. In one instance, a message was relayed from the raft to W3FNG, delivered by telephone to the embassy. An answer procured and relayed in the reverse direction to Kon-Tiki, all in the manner of 35 minutes. On August 7th, after hitting the reef, the Kon-Tiki set up their Gibson Girl powered rig, which enabled the Kon-Tiki hams to contact ZK-1AB in less than 30 minutes after running aground. After being picked up by the native Cook Islanders, LI-2B was on the air within 5 days before shutting down for good. And Ted, I will talk probably very shortly about the station in Pennsylvania, but if you'd like to come aboard at this time, you can come aboard and make comments. But are there any comments of anyone out there about wet equipment, about antennas getting bit off by parrots. They'd like to come aboard this evening and make some comments before we move on with the next question.
Six, Victor.
Come aboard with your comments.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. I was going to ask Ted up there, L-O-U, when he got started in all of this. You know, I'm having a little trouble with being too old and not being able to remember back that far. But I was first licensed in January of 1949. My father had been hamming since 1921. The problem that I'm having with this is there was a blankout of any amateur radio activity during World War II. And then several years after the war had settled down, things started to come back into vogue. So if we say 1945, 1946, we're getting very close to this voyage on 1947. And I recall that the first thing that was opened up amateur radio-wise after WW2 was 2 meters. None of the HF bands were opened up at that point. And I'm not sure when that happened. Ted, do you go back that far? Any comments on that? Over.
Well, yeah, this is WB12U. I think I can help clarify that a little bit. The information that I have is kind of unique, but you're right. There was this restriction after World War II on amateur radio, and I think you're also correct about it being opened up at first in the 2-meter area. The information that I have that I found is that the American contacts that occurred in 1947, that is the we'll call them the authorized contacts, were actually controlled by the U.S. Army. And I'm not sure where Kathy wants to go with this, but I have some specific information about what happened locally here in Pennsylvania in this regard during the Kon-Tiki expedition. So I can provide that information, and Kathy, if you want to do that now, let me know.
Let me see if I've got it here, Tim. Well, that answers an awful lot of questions for me, if that was controlled by the Army Communication Field Office or whatever. You know, the 13.990 bothered me, too. Now, I know why they ended up there, because they had to tune down to 20 meters from a 10-meter radio in order to get airborne, and they couldn't get up any higher than 13.999 or 990. Was that also Army sanctioned? Do you happen to know, sir? Over.
At that time, I think nothing was being prohibited. From the information I found, I think they used the frequency that they found usable. What worked, worked.
Well, that makes sense, you know. Use what you can use. Back to you, Kathy. Thank you, KY6V.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for staying connected and listening. I hope that you've learned a lot in the history as well as the involvement of ham radio and of the raft itself. But at this point, I want to call on Mike, WA1NXI, to please come aboard. And it's a shame that your dad, Mick, couldn't stay connected, but it's always recorded. If he wanted to listen to it, it could be made available. So WA1NXI, could you come in and ask me the next question? And thanks so much once again for being there.
Good evening again, Kathy, and everyone listening. Very, very interesting net so far, and I've learned quite a lot. And I wonder if they ever got Steve's call sign and sent him a QSL card and thanked him for hanging up on him, if they ever let him know that they were serious and how he felt about that. But anyway, the question, Kathy, and I know that you talked about the equipment on board, but could you go into a little bit further detail?
Yes, I will be happy to go aboard with her and talk a little bit about the equipment. I've talked about a lot of it. But, Mike, I think his name was Paul that you're talking about in Colorado that thought it was just a joke. But, yeah, hopefully that some of that came aboard and he could understand it wasn't a joke. But let me talk a little bit about the equipment. Most of you have heard some of the equipment, but I do want to go into more detail. We're all ham radio operators, and we're all very interested in different types of equipment. And so I really wanted to go into more detail with this. But the Contiki carried 257 gallons of drinking water and 56 water cans. Now think about this raft. If you've seen pictures of this, I often wonder where they put these water cans. For food, they took 200 coconuts, sweet potatoes, bottle gourds, and other assorted fruits and roots. And with the water coming aboard, I often think that washed overboard. The U.S. Army Quartermaster Corps provided field rations, tinned food, and survival equipment. The crew's daily life included the catching and cooking of fish, particularly flying fish, dolphin fish, yellowfin, tuna, bonito, and shark. And George could come aboard and tell us about all of these. Storing of water and repairing of lashings and other raft parts, as well as whale watching, diving, singing, and dangers such as sharks. And I hope everyone can come aboard, and if they've looked at the site, can tell me more information. Ham radio activities enabled the men to maintain contact with cohorts in Norway and Los Angeles, and ham radio was very, very important. The exposition used the call sign. I've told you the call sign, LI2B, and carried three watertight radio transmitters. They first operated on 40 and 20 meters, second on 10 meters, and third on 6 meters. Each transmitter used 2E30 tubes in all stages and ran about 10 watts input. The modulator used 2E30s and used only a single tube, simplified spare part stocking. As an emergency backup, the Contiki carried a German Mark V transceiver, originally recreated by Britain's Special Operations Executive in 1942. Other equipment included a Gibson Girl hand-cranked emergency transceiver for use in the marine bands, a VHF radio for contacting aircraft, and two British II transmitters. The heart of the Contiki's communication was, of course, the National Radio NC-173 receiver. All the rigs were powered by a combination of dry batteries and a hand-cranked generator. Dry batteries were used rather than rechargeable wet cells because there was concern wet cell batteries might spill acid and cause damage. The Contiki carried a total of 41 6-volt and 30 45-volt batteries. Individual cells of the 45-volt batteries were used in series parallel to provide the 6-volt needed for the filaments, extending battery life, so the batteries were able to continue operating for the duration of the trip. The transceivers were built without meters because meters were felt to be too fragile for the planned journey. An antenna tuning unit utilizing a PI network was used. Each of the units was built into its own watertight aluminum box with power input and output connectors made leak-proof by use of rubber gaskets. Specifications called for emission of meters in all equipment since it was thought that they might become useless after continued use under such severe conditions. All tuning up was done by the familiar amateur procedure of using neon bulbs and lamp loops. The main receiver chosen for the station was NC-173, like I've talked about before. Other equipment carried included a hand-cranked emergency set of Gibson Girl type for 58280 KC, a special VHF set for connecting aircraft, and two of the famous British 316 MC Mark II transmitters. After early trials of various antennas, the antenna chosen for all operation was an end-fed wire supported at the far end by the raft's 40-foot mast. The exposition with the amateur radio call sign again LI2B maintained regular communication with a number of American, Canadian, South American stations that kept the Norwegian embassy in Washington, D.C. abreast of the Contiki's efforts. They also had maps and diagrams that helped show how trade winds in the Southern Pacific always moved in a northwesterly direction, creating a consistent current from South America to the Marquesas Islands. The Contiki's radio receiver, once again, was at NC-173. It slowly dried out on an uninhabited South Sea island after getting soaked in the shipwreck, gradually receiving at higher and higher frequencies until eventually settling on the 13.990 megahertz frequency needed to make contact. The crew used their hand-cranked emergency transmitter to send out an all well message via their call sign just in time to head off that massive rescue attempt. So, anyone out there, my staff, any listeners that'd like to come aboard and make any comments about their equipment, anything I've talked about, anything about antennas, if so, come aboard with a suffix. Once again, this is Kilo 6 Sierra United November.
6, Victor.
November X-ray India.
Well, thank you both Gordon and Mike for coming aboard, letting my voice drop for a short time so I can catch my voice again. So KY6V, I'll first go to you and then I will call on you at WA1XI. Please come aboard 6 Victor, and once again, I appreciate your help this evening and I hope that you're enjoying.
I certainly am, Kathy. Just absolutely, totally interesting. You know, that comment about not wanting to have meters because of their fragile nature on this trip reminded me, and I'll bet you a lot of the people that are listening right now don't know that this can be done. They were talking about using light bulbs and what have you to tune their transmitters. I built my first transmitter, which was an 807 in the final, out of a schematic in QST back in 1949. It had an 807 in the final. That's not important. What was important was this thing had plug-in coils to change bands. I'd have to unplug the set that was in there, plug another set in order to change from 40 to 20 or whatever. But it didn't have a meter in it, Kathy, and what I did is I had a single loop soldered on to a little light bulb. That light bulb was similar to one of these little flashlight bulbs that you'd look at, like a GE-47. And you'd put that over the tank coil, and you'd start resonating the transmitter, tuning the final. And what you did is that when you got the light as bright as it could be, you'd stop, and you were there. Now, how's that for dating me? KY6V, go ahead, ma'am.
Very nice comments, and I appreciate you coming aboard with that. So WA1NXI, thanks so much for being there. But Mike, come aboard and make your comments.
WA1NXI, well, that's exactly what my comment was about, was the fish, and I enjoyed reading the notebook that they kept, that you sent a copy of, In it, they talk about how easy the fishing was and how the schools of fish just seemed to follow along the raft and hide under the raft for protection, and fish actually jumped right onto the raft. But that was my comment, and I didn't see him say anything about lobsters either, but there was other small fish that they caught with nets. But that was a very interesting thing to read, was the actual notes that they kept during the journey. Very, very interesting stuff. And WA1NXI, back to net.
And Lima, Charlie Bravo.
Thanks once again for being there this evening, George, and bring aboard your comments.
Well, thank you, Kathy. KW4, Lima, Charlie Bravo. Well, first thing was on my mind is what this crew went through in an open vessel. Well, they did have a little type cabin constructed, but they took a pretty good beating. And if you were out on the sea floating around through some of the storms they went through, they got beat up pretty bad and went through a lot. And some of the pictures before and after, and the ones after, they was cleaned up a little bit, but it's very challenging to be out in open water, away from any land whatsoever. Maybe occasionally they might saw a tanker or something off in the distance, I just don't know, but it's a very awesome feeling. Just like you would go in the woods and hear the sounds of the woods. You have them sounds of the sea, what's out there, too, you know, and it's can be very traumatic. And I'm quite sure there was a bunch of tempers that flared. I'm quite sure at times there was thoughts of mutiny and everything else that goes with it. But the flying fish, yeah, they're forever riding the waves, and they just drop their tail down in the sea, and I mean, they come zooming through, you know, fly on deck, and you just pick them up. It mentioned they did have a shark on board, what I saw, and just by looking at it, it reminded me of what we call a lemon shark. It looked to be about, you know, 5 to 6 feet long. And, you know, the tuna and the bonita, there is a fish they call a bonita, which is a false albacore tuna, which is very, very delicious there. And your Saragossan weed. And the seaweed, this little shrimp. I have shaking some out, you know, a half inch to an inch long, you know, and all different kind of little fish. So there's always food there. And the raft itself, you know, sitting up on the surface of the water as the sun gets above it, that might throw a shadow a mile wide and long, you know, at 500 or 600 feet below the surface, and fish to congregate in the coolness there. And it was an adventure. I'm sad to say I was just a year old at the time, but I have been out there on that ocean, stranded with nobody around, and be beaten up by the seas, and just hoping I'd see a tanker or something come by, but that was another time. But I can really feel what these guys went through, and as far as their radio equipment getting watered down and tend the frantic stage of them trying to get back in the air in a certain time, yeah, it was a trip. KW4 Lima, Charlie Bravo.
The next one, I'm going to turn over to Suzanne. If you're there, I'm turning it over to you for the next question.
Well, hello, Kathy. This is N1SUZ. Of course I'm still here, and I'm really enjoying the program tonight. And I do have a comment. I thought it was very interesting that LI2B kept a schedule with W1AW during their voyage. Those contacts would have been made from the same location that I operated from this summer, because W1AW has been at that current location since 1933. So I thought that was really interesting, and I didn't know that until we started this discussion. So thank you for sharing that. And along those same lines, I know you've already talked about the expedition's call sign, LI2B, but is there any other information about the station and the contacts made that you can share with us tonight, Kathy? And I'll send it back to you, N1SUZ, back to K6SUN.
This is where I'm going to talk a little bit about the stations that Ted wants to talk about, and I'm going to turn it to him so he can clarify it further, but I've talked a lot about the call sign, but I'm very happy to just go into further detail. The Kon-Tiki was, like I said, very unusual exposition that placed reliance on amateur radio for communication. The exposition, again, used that call sign, LI2B. And I talked a bit earlier about the equipment, the frequencies, and equipment they use, so hopefully I won't go into any further detail. But I do want to talk about the station itself. It was used by Heyerdahl once again in 1969 and 1970 when he built another raft and sailed from Morocco to Barbados in an attempt to show a possible link between the civilization of ancient Egypt and the New World. So I just wanted to put that in there. But the Kon-Tiki faced a lot of dangers, countless dangers, like George was saying. Amateur radio can feel flattered that it was asked to assist in such an unusual undertaking. In late 1946, AWRL was approached by LA01GA. This is the Assistant Military Attaché on the Norwegian Embassy staff in Washington, who requested amateur cooperation. LA1GA had received the assignment of organizing radio communications for the exposition. He had worked out a communication plan which entailed the use of normal marine channels for emergency purposes and the 7, 14, 28, and 50 MC bands for contacts with amateurs. Authority had been received for Kon-Tiki to use the call sign LI2B. After numerous discussions of amateur requirements, ARRL alerted a group of amateurs to assist. The following were among those initially selected. And I won't say all of them, but the one I want to talk about is W3YA. There were a lot of others, and maybe some of those call signs will come up again. But this station was provided by the State College, Pennsylvania, and this is what Ted wants to talk about. Students and faculty members kept the station, college station, in regular direct touch with the exposition. Schedules were maintained nightly to expedite delivery of traffic. W3YA assisted in relaying information from LI2B to Norway, in some cases direct to LA1C, at other times via schedules with W1AW and other stations. So, Ted, can you come aboard and give us some further information about the station there in Pennsylvania? And I know this is what she wanted to talk to us about. So, LOU, Ted, now it's your turn to come aboard and tell us about Pennsylvania.
Well, good evening again, everybody. This is Ted, WB12EU. This is kind of, I won't say intimidating, but I'm kind of proud about where I'm at and what I've experienced. Where I live, it's the home of the Pennsylvania State University. And basically what happened here in 1947 follows much what Kathy just described. The only thing I can add to it is that I dug into this a little bit deeper and I found some records in the university's archives about this. It's a little sketchy, but it is available. It's a public records. But basically, very early in the year of 1947, at the request of the Norwegian Embassy and ARRL, the Chief Signal Office of the Army and the Norwegian Embassy in Washington, D.C., submitted a request to have the Penn State University amateur radio station, which at the time was shut down because of the amateur radio restrictions. They wanted that radio station to provide the primary contact between the Kon-Tiki expedition and the Norwegian Embassy in Washington, D.C. When weather and propagation conditions were appropriate. Actually, what ended up happening was that they were able to maintain contact with the raft almost every morning at 3 a.m. on roughly the 20-meter band. They also, for the understanding and help to the families of the crew, they also were able to contact the raft at 11 p.m. in the evening. And that traffic then was exchanged basically for the benefit of the families and the crew. What I also found out was that during the time they were out there in the Pacific, the government, that is the Signal Corps, decided to work with the United States Weather Bureau. And what they actually did, they communicated with the Kon-Tiki raft and gathered very early propagation data. It was one of the earliest recorded attempts to actually record propagation data based on meteorological studies. The interesting thing here is that that has been missed is that there was a great deal of communications on 10 meters. And believe it or not, it was not code. It was AM. They actually communicated by voice on 10 meters. And at that time, you got to understand, I'm about 12 years old. And I have this really keen interest in electricity and electronics. I don't know what I'm doing. But my uncle gave me a shortwave radio, and I listened to the Kon-Tiki in contact with our local amateur radio station here at the university. And it was exciting stuff. It really was. I remember it very well. I even have some notes written into an old notebook about that. And it was an exciting time for me, and in a way it probably influenced me quite a bit. But I just found all this information about this voyage absolutely just intriguing. It's captured my mind. I actually went out and purchased a official copy of the video. I also found a copy of some of the color film that was taken that was destroyed, but the good stuff is still available, so I have a copy of that. Very, very interesting thing. And somewhere in my library of books, I actually have the book that was published in 1950.
Well, thank you, Ted. I know there's a lot of books out there, and I knew that you could tell us information about Pennsylvania Station, and it's great that you could have listened to that. That had to be exciting, and I hope that it has been interesting for you tonight. I'm sure you know most of this information. I hope that you're enjoying it, and maybe some little part is new to you, but maybe not. But thanks so much, Ted, for coming aboard with that information for all of us. I will finish out the part about the station, and then we'll go on to the next question. But in spite of all the careful advanced planning to reduce their technical difficulties, the operators still had difficulty with certain elements of their equipment. The supply of the dry batteries arrived in Peru so late that there was no opportunity to pack them in watertight cases. Heavy seas were encountered during the first few days, and part of the heater battery reserve was damaged by exposure to water. Humidity was also so great that the capacity of the cells fell considerably even when not in use. After 2 months at sea, all heater batteries were down to 4 volts. Fortunately, the plate batteries with their light drain were holding up well. The operators disassembled some of the latter, rewired the cells in parallel, and provided heater supplies of adequate capacity to keep the station on the air. During the last month of the voyage, much time was spent repairing these batteries as the supply dwindled. After being used for 1 month, the crystal of the 14MC transmitter was fractured. New crystals were installed, but also became defective. The only alternative left was to tune the 10-meter rig to 14MC, the resulting frequency forcing LI2B to 13990 KC. These equipment difficulties were not serious to keep them off the air, but it kept them off the air for 4 days. After being taken off the reef by the natives, and I've gone into this with you, I won't go any further, they were on the air for 5 days, and the little village, they were only active for 5 days. French authorities allowed the station LI2B to open once more aboard the government ship Tamara, which took the men to Tahiti, where the station was operated ashore and made its final contact with amateurs. Are there any contacts, any further contacts about this question these comments that were made by Ted or anyone else. Or if you would like to make a comment or a question, please come aboard with your suffix.
November X-ray India.
6, Victor.
Whiskey Kilo Delta.
WA1NXI, please come aboard with your comment or your question.
I just have a quick comment, Kathy. I was going to say that it would have been great to be a ham back then, and I know if I was, I would have been chasing that DX for sure. I'm sure they didn't have the technology of today, the internet, to track DX. Like, I can look it up on the internet today, but I'm sure word got around, and a lot of people were chasing that particular call. That was my comment, Captain.
Well, thank you for that, Mike. KY6V, thanks so much for being there, for being a participant, and for sticking with me tonight during this long session. Come aboard with your comments.
Thanks, Kathy. KY6V here. Well, I've learned a couple of things tonight. I just wanted to, with tongue-in-cheek, mention, Kathy, that MC, following the frequency, stands for megacycle. And I had to sit back and sort of grin and think that I got austerized. I got put in my place the other night by Greg, you know, one of my engineering cohorts up there in New Jersey. I'm talking about WE2Q. I mentioned megacycles, and he came back and he says, "What's that? Shouldn't it be megahertz?" Well, what has happened back in about that period of time, cycles went from hertz, or went to hertz, and it really hurt. Back to you, KY6V, over.
Well, thank you for that. I guess that must have been during the extra course, and I didn't hear that. I remember listening to you when you did the Back to Basic, talking about your dad, when it went from cycles to hertz, I believe, that it really hurt. I hope you're not hurt too much this evening about me saying MC or megacycles. So thanks for coming aboard, and thanks for everything that you're doing tonight. So,
Lima, Charlie Bravo, when you had talked about crystals and being fractured, I just wondered if they took any with them. You know, back then, you used to sand a crystal down to get the frequency that you wanted. Then years later, they came enclosed in the little cans where you plug them in and all. Maybe somebody might want to elaborate on that just a bit there. You know, that was the thought was going through my mind when they was speaking about fractured crystals.
KY6B, can you answer George's question? If so, come aboard.
Well, I'll try, Kathy. Hi, George. With my limited exposure to what they were going through, what I've read is that the crystals cracked, and I assume cracked sufficiently where they couldn't be sanded or touched upon. Of course, when you do that, you change the frequency, but that was probably immaterial. It was just inoperative. The crystal was cracked to the point where it wouldn't oscillate. And what I read is that they had some spare crystals, and they plugged those in, but those cracked also. Now, I don't know if it was because of the environment they were in or what. And the story goes, as I understand it, is that they couldn't get the 20-meter transmitter operating because of the crystal problem. And they took their 10-meter transmitter, which was an independent box, and tuned it down to 20 meters and operated that way. And the only frequency they could end up was just below the 20-meter band, which was this 13... what was it, 990 or something, George? I mean, if the crystal itself cracks in half, you can't glue it, George, over.
I hear you, sir. Yeah, and I did catch the other night on the megacycle, and I did catch tonight on the megacycle again. So very interesting phenomenon. Don't forget the killer cycles. KW4A, my Charlie Bravo.
I'd reverse that. Don't forget the cycles. The heck with this hertz. Go ahead, Kathy. KY6V, over.
I do want to call on Gordon once again.
No problem, Kathy. There were additional expeditions by Thor, but others as well. Can you explain a few and then open the to the audience in case they know of additional expeditions? I've mentioned the Lehi. You're knowledgeable of the, what do they call it, the junk raft or something? Go ahead, Kathy, KY6B.
All right, I was going to go into a lot more detail on this, but I think I can make this one a lot shorter. Heyerdahl, after the Kon-Tiki, had several. He had the Galapos, he had the Kon-Tiki too, he had the Eastern Island. But he had all of these expositions that he did after this. But there were a lot of imitators that after the success of this exposition, it really was a success. They made it to where they wanted to make. But there were some that met with failure. But he also, he had he called it the RA1 and 2. But I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. But he had a lot that he tried after that. And there was some, there's one that was supposed to have been this year. And believe it or not, everyone, it was supposed to be four senior citizens. They were going to model it after the Kon-Tiki. They were going on a 3,000-mile journey, 70 days. I haven't heard much about that. But I just want to say that Heyerdahl went into a lot more expositions after the Kon-Tiki, but I won't go into all of them because there's quite a few. But I want to talk about this junk raft, and I found this rather amusing. There were two individuals who sailed from Long Beach, California, on a boat made of 15,000 plastic bottles and an old Cessna 310 fuselage, which they appropriately called junk. These two individuals took this little 2,600-mile cruise in order to bring awareness to the issue of ocean pollution. The team made land at the harbor on the Hawaiian island of Oahu. It was a harbor, meeting their goal, and then some. Their speed was 3.2 knots, and it wasn't a fast ride, but they weren't serious about it, but they made steady pace. But thanks to modern communication equipment, we're able to send photos and videos from the sea to bring special attention to the Pacific Ocean pollution. And I just thought that was rather amusing. And like I said, their website is Yacht Pales, and you may want to check that out. At this point, I'm going to call on George.
Well, you got me running on that one, Kathy. Yeah, in fact, that I was looking over it now. I understand there was an article printed in December 1947 in the QST. Can you explain what might have been written in that article? That's what I was there at the bookcase looking it up, see if I had it there. Maybe you could enlighten us a little bit.
All right. Thank you, George. I found this quite interesting. So the conditions under which the amateur radio aboard the raft was to operate presented many unusual problems. Proximity of the craft's deck to the sea and the relatively small protection afforded by the thatched bamboo cabin meant that the gear would have to withstand the effects of moisture. It was desired to have transmitter units light and tight enough so that if they should fall overboard, they could be fished out and put to work again immediately. Operation was required on maritime and amateur frequencies. Both phone and CW were specified. The transmitters were to be tuned, closed up, and remain watertight unless something went wrong. It must be possible to load them on antennas of whatever length could be erected on available supports. With this in mind, W1CTW and W1EHT of the National Company's engineering staff designed and constructed the needed rigs. One transmitter was built to operate on 7 and 14 megahertz, megacycles, another for 28, and a third for 50. And again, this was the most unusual exposition ever to place reliance on amateur radio for communication. And once again, that was something, with some other comments that were in the QST magazine, but I just mainly wanted to say about that, that this was an exposition that placed a lot of reliance on amateur radio for communication. But we'll move on to the final question and the final person giving the question this evening, and it seems like I've overworked him this evening.
Not to fear, Kathy, the bill is in the mail. Gordon here, KY6V. You know, in summation here, what were some of the dangers on their 101-day journey?
As their journey began, they observed 50 blue water porpoises at one side of the raft. Porpoise continued to accompany the raft, and you know porpoises aren't dangerous. Some of the whales were longer than the raft. Sea was filled with life, tuna fishes, flying fishes, dolphins, sharks, whales, turtles. They were fish for sharks with their bare hands. The Kentucky explorers discovered the legendary snake mackerel. And George, you may be able to tell me something about this, and I can't pronounce the Latin name, but it's Gemmopilus, maybe, and had a rare sighting of the whale shark. Heyerdahl had experiences with two specimens of the snake mackerel, a fish which had never previously been seen alive by man, when they jumped aboard from out of the deep. The first was at night when the snake mackerel was washed into one of the radio operator's sleeping bag. The second was also at night when this same mackerel tried to attack the lantern. The whale shark, huge inside, hence its name, was so big that as it swam under the raft, the explorers could see its huge flat head on one side and its tail on the other. After about 1 hour of the whale shark circling the raft, a crew member rammed a harpoon into its skull. The whale shark simply broke the harpoon and swam away. So anyone that's gone into and gotten some further information or has some additional information they'd like to share this evening.
WKD.
6, Victor.
3, Bravo.
November 1, Sierra United Zulu.
So I'm going to start with you, George, LCB, and thanks so much for being there.
Kathy, I have had personal experience with whale sharks. It's a very docile creature. You can even go right up to it and or swim up to it and pet it on the side. Or, you know, it's a plankton-eating fish. So, or a small krill or things like that, it's the only danger that it might be if it, you know, it got up right up against the raft and it got spooked or happened to come up under the raft, you know, that could be dangerous. But it's a real broad, and we was in a boat 63 foot long, and it was longer than that, so that's the size you know they can get. As far as and I've also had experience with what they call this a mackerel snake. It's quite unusual looking. It does well. It's got a head just like a mackerel and a real shiny skin like the mackerel. Well, you've got two other different kinds of mackerel, the Ciro and the Spanish. But this one is long and slender, very silvery shiny. And what I know about it, it's a deep water form of fish there, and there's some strange creatures out there in the deep. I've seen snakes come up at night, you know, to a light, would, you know, be hanging over the stern of a boat there and fishing out, you know, 600, 1,000 feet of water, and And like I said, some nights it gets spooky there. And like I said, the biggest fear factor would be the compatibility of everyone, you know. Being out there in the sun too long and get your brain baked there, you know, you want to do some real weird things. Especially if your water supply gets low and, you know, you need that water to keep your head on straight there. And, you know, like I said earlier through the session there, I have been there. Well, I hadn't walked as far, but I had did the walk. So it was a very interesting a topic, a very interesting voyage, and made a raft or two. And what can I say? I grew up with Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, KW4, my Charlie Bravo.
Well, I know better than that, but I know that you've been around the water and on the water all the time, so this is just natural for you. But I'm going to call on you shortly to do a global net about those interesting stories again. Some of these are very interesting, and everyone would love to hear some of these nice stories out in the water. So I'll break with you, George. Thanks so much for being there this evening and for whatever you do for South Cars, and especially being part of my team this evening. I've liked your comments. Suzanne, thanks so much for being there this evening, being part of the team. And what are your comments about what has been said about the hazards or maybe anything that's been said this evening? And once again, thanks for being there.
Well, thank you, Kathy. This is N1SUZ, and I just wanted to thank you for a very interesting presentation. And thanks for all your hard work in researching all this. You know, I don't often read adventure stories, but you motivated me to start reading the book, and I'm really enjoying it. So I would just say thank you very much, and it was a great presentation. And I would encourage anybody that enjoyed the presentation to actually get the book, Kon-Tiki by Thor Heyerdahl, because he really is a great writer, and he also makes it sound very exciting to be out on the seas. But just wanted to say thank you, Kathy, and thanks to everybody who helped out tonight. So this is N1SUZ, back to K6SUN.
So with that, I'm going to call in KY6V.
You know, the comments that I had, I think George is pretty well covered, and thank you for that, George. I would probably ask just a subtle question or two about what you have covered. But it's been a great, great evening, Kathy, a great subject. I think what's so germane here is a lot of people do a lot of things, put a lot of extra effort into it, whether it's sailing across the Pacific on a raft or climbing to the moon. But the fact that amateur radio was such an integral part of this, I think, just sells the story for me. George, the questions I was going to ask about the, you know, the shark, or the shark whale, I should say. You said that they're very docile. Do they ever get mean? Is it just when they get spooked? You know, you take something that massive that rams the raft. The raft is in pieces. Goes underneath and comes up, and you're in a world of hurt. I don't know if that ever happens. Apparently, it's only if this poor dude is spooked for some reason. The other question is, on this snake mackerel, is it got a mouth full of teeth? Is its slender body sharp and piercing? I mean, what the heck happens to you when it joins you in your sleeping bag, George? Over.
Well, Gordon, Well, evidently it was chasing the fish, you know, and the fish hit the boat, or if it was chasing a flying fish, or, you know, like I mentioned earlier, A flying fish gets its momentum by following the surf, and all he does, he's got his wings spread out, and he dips his tail, and a flicker of the tail gives him more momentum. And I have seen fish chasing these flying fish, okay, and that's a very possible as to how that mackerel wound up on that raft, since it had very little freeboard, you know, very little height, for those who doesn't know what I'm talking about. He landed in the raft. Now, a mackerel or a kingfish, which is in the mackerel family, you don't even have to look. If one hits you on the arm or the leg, you know you've been cut. I mean, their teeth are razor sharp. And like I said, it's long, it's slender. You know, it's basically, you know, the head and the body is just like the mackerel. But the tail tapers right on down as to like a snake's tail. Now, I've never researched it as far as if it's edible or anything, you know, so I can't say as to that.
Before you go there, George, what happened to this guy in the poor sleeping bag? Over.
Well, I didn't read where anything happened, but I guarantee you he come up with a new dance. I mean, he was shifting and shiving, and you know, if he got bit, he bled, and they some very serious cut. You know, I've got scars all over me from mackerel and kingfish you know, hit me. So very easy. You know, they could take a limb off, you know, but he could, I tell you what, I'd be what they call boot scooting, boogieing on out of there, you know, getting away. You know, it's just like waking up at night in a sleeping bag and find a snake in there. You'll set the woods on fire or making a path. I know I would be, because, like I said, I do know how sharp their teeth is. And, of course, the sliminess of a fish there would really get me thinking snake.
You've just got me cracking apart here, George. Yeah, I wouldn't know if it was a snake or a mackerel at that point, but I'd be booging too. Okay, on this shark whale, I've never seen one, George, and apparently they get very big. But do they get mean at times or just when they're spooked? Over.
Well, Gordon, I've only, you know, seen three or four of them in my time. But everyone I've seen has always been docile. I did have an experience that day out on the boat, and you know, we was within 20 feet of it on the boat there, and one of the crew members there decided he's gonna catch that sucker, and we always had a big line out for sharks, you know, and this is about a quarter of an inch nylon rope with a hook is about big as your fist. So what he did, we had a half a bonito on for bait, and we knew the shark wouldn't take it. So he took the bait off, and he was going to throw that hook over his back and snag him, and he ran back to heave that line, and I grabbed him by the back of his shirt and by his pants, and I told him, I said, when you hook him, you go in too. And he decided right then and there he wasn't going to try that. And, you know, and it's like any a foul hook fish, you know, they're stronger because you pulling them from the side. They get all mean. And as close as that he was on the surface, he could have busted us up pretty good. And I wasn't going to go through that. You know, it was just beautiful. If you ever see a deer, a fawn deer with the spots and the brown, that's on top of his back, or a leopard shark. Reminds me of a lot of a leopard shark, with the dots and all. And the mouth would be more, well, it was pointed, you know, and just a beautiful, massive fish. And I hope that answers your question. And a passing thought, I have spent many a day in the Marquesas Islands, but that's the last stop before you get to Dry Tortugas, where Dr. Samuel Mudd was imprisoned at there. But I've been to the Marquesas also. KW4 Lima, Charlie Bravo.
Thank you very much for sharing that, George. Very much appreciated.
Thank you both, George and Gordon, for your conversation. And once again, thanks for being there as my co-host this evening. But I hope, Gordon, that you're not walking away because you have to close the net this evening. So, Jim, it's your turn. Please come aboard.
You know, Kathy, thank you. KJ4WKD here, Jim. And Kathy, I was going to be serious, believe it or not, and make some comments, but you asked me to do the announcements. So the announcements are, as usual, we need NCS and administrative people. And if anyone is interested, and we really, really need NCS folks to do these nets for us. It's a lot of fun. You'd enjoy it. And you really get to know the people on South Cars when you do the nets, and you're just out there and meet a lot of people when you do that. So please contact us if you'd like to be an NCS and you think you'd like to do it. And you can contact us at VOIP@southcars.com. And also, in addition to that, worldwide hospitality people are also required to act as South Cars ambassadors of goodwill.
Well, it looks like Jim is still timed out. Gordon, KY6V, would you like to come and continue with the extra course where he left off, maybe, and maybe he can come back and finish his announcement before we end this evening's session? KY6V, can you help out here?
I'll give it a try, Kathy. KY6V here. I see Jim is still timed out. Jim was talking about our outreach program, guys and gals, and we're very elated and very happy about how it was going. Jim says he wasn't sure when it started. Actually, our first class was offered on South Cars and on this server in April of last year, 2010. We started off with the technician class, and then we moved on with the general class, and then we moved on with the extra class for 2010. And then we started this year with an international Morse code class in the early part of 2011. We moved on to the general class only because that license pool was changing effective July 1st of this year. A lot of people had started their efforts of getting ready to take the exam, and we didn't want to change pool questions on them, so we ran that early. We then followed up with the technician license, and then we moved on to the extra class that we are now coming up on our fifth class of the session, and this should probably be completed around the 13th of September as we see it. Kathy, anything else before we close it out?
So any other comments before we close this evening session?
November X-ray India. Well, I just want to say it was an awesome net, Kathy, and I plan on continuing learning about the Kon-Tiki. I'm going to pick the book up and read it. And very excellent topic, and I learned a lot here tonight, and thank you for doing it. WA1NXI, back to net.
All right, I want to thank you, Mike, as well as all the participants that helped me out this evening with the questions and the comments. And I hope that you can all join us on Saturday for the Nets. Please check out our website, www.vorp.southcars.com, for the schedule this Saturday. But I guess it's time for me to slow my voice down so I can talk and head to bed so I can get up for my last training session in the morning and begin my school week next week. But thanks once again to each and every one of you. Have a great evening and a great rest of the week.
Good night, everybody. Thank you very much for staying with us. Interesting program. Thank you very much, Kathy, and for your crew. That would include Jim and Mike and Suzanne and Rob. We'll give him credentials, even though he didn't make it here tonight. And, of course, George. Take a look at our website for schedules, guys and gals, voip.southcars.com. We've got a lot coming up here on Saturday, and that's only 2 days in front of us. Good night, all, and thank you. KY6V returning the SCAR server back to normal use and abuse and saying hasta la bye-bye.